packs into a sentence. So what are we saying about how they think? It's one thing to talk about the romanticness of the Hopi, but what about a language like Chinese where you might look at the grammar and wonder if they say much of anything at all? That doesn't seem to get talked about very much. There was one experiment where somebody looked at that nature of Chinese and suggested that maybe the Chinese are a little less sensitive to associations between events than we are, things that require the expression of words like although and if. Needless to say, that person wasn't allowed to play any more reindeer games anymore because this time the Westerners came out ahead. So you have to be very careful with this kind of paradigm when you look at all languages as opposed to the ones that happen to interest Worf. Then there are experiments. People throughout the years have certainly tried to support Worf scientifically on this. And the thing is, it never really comes out in a very interesting way. So, for example, Navajo. Navajo has different verbs for handling things, depending on their shape. A lot of Native American languages have a kind of a shape of things fetish. A lot of languages do. It's not a European thing, but it's common around the world. And so, if you're handling something and it's long and flexible, I presume that that means something like pasta. What's long and flexible? A dead snake. I don't know. But the word for it is shanle. But if you're handling something that's long and rigid, like a big giant pencil or recorder or something like that, then the word is shanti. So it's different. So the idea is that Navajo seems to have this grammatical sensitivity to the proportions and the shapes of objects. Now, there was an experiment. It was a small one, but let's face it, all experiments can't be like an FDA test. It was a small but interesting experiment. Navajo kids, if given a whole bunch of objects, tended more to distinguish them by form and shape rather than by size and color as English-speaking kids did. So English-speaking kids put things together in terms of, this one is big and red, big red, big blue, big red. Whereas the Navajo kids thought of it as form and shape. So the round ones here, the long flexible ones here, and the long stiff ones here. So that seemed kind of interesting, and that was thought of as an indication that the Navajo grammar must shape how you approach the world. But then it was kind of interesting that they did another experiment where black kids from Harlem were more likely to use the size and the color, whereas it was the white kids who tended to use shape and form. So here's a whole different kind of experiment. Not only are the white kids doing something different, but it's a difference that's based on local race and apparently, after we look at all of these Navajo experiments, class issue. So it's not about the Navajo grammar. It's not about specific Navajo culture. It seems to be about something else. And whatever we're going to say about that, it's not what Worf would have predicted. Another Navajo study was interesting. The idea was that the Navajo traditionally have been nomads, and so we would expect a certain sensitivity to motion and going in Navajo. And there was one scholar who noted that Navajo has separate particles that you can put on a kind of all-purpose motion verb so that you can have move on all fours. Then you add another particle, and it's move at a run, or move by flying, or move by floating on water, or move by rolling. So the idea was that these particles that all describe moving in different ways must mean that a Navajo person is very sensitized to motion because it used to be the Navajo way to always be in motion. You can set that to music. It's such a beautiful notion. And I've heard some other linguists talk about verbs of going in the languages of their group and talking about how the group always seems to be going. But first of all, one question is, what people don't move much? You know, I'm not aware of the stationary culture. Even if you are staying in the same place, people walk, people dance, people run. I'm not aware of people where you couldn't say, golly, they move a lot. Even if it's a stationary culture, you might say, well, golly, they love to race. Or, well, golly, they dance every Tuesday night. And more to the point, if you look at Navajo, there is moving on all fours. Well, it's interesting that in English, we also have a way of distinguishing that action. We say crawl. It's not with a particle, but we do have the word crawl. Or they have a particle that means that you're moving at a run. We have a word run, and so on. So Navajo doesn't have single words crawl, fly, run. Navajo has this kind of go verb, and then with the particles, you modify what kind it is. Ours just happen to be single words, but Navajo doesn't have those words. So in other words, English and Navajo are the same. So when they say move by floating on water, we would say float. Those are equivalent sorts of things. So one doesn't want to overly exotify the grammars in a quest to elevate the nature of the speakers. Now, what's important is that there have been examples of experiments where Worf's ideas are confirmed in small ways, and those are important to mention too. There are many languages in the world where the word for green and blue is the same. So there are many languages where you'll have red, yellow, and what linguists often call gru. There's often a gru term, which is green and blue. And we can imagine, you know, if it's 1993, the color teal is very popular. Remember when every second car was teal. It's maddeningly difficult to determine whether those cars are green or blue. Well, for many people, that nexus is such that green and blue are the same color. You can understand that. Now, there's a group of hunter-gatherers in Papua New Guinea. They're called the Birimmo, and they have a gru term. For them, there is no separate green or blue. And there was an experiment done which showed that actually they are rather slow at distinguishing between a green chip and a blue chip. They get it. They're humans. They can see the difference. But they don't distinguish as quickly as an English speaker would. We see a green and a blue, and it's like immediately, oh, well, they're green, blue. For them, I suppose, if you put yourself in the mind of a Birimmo, it's, well, there's a gru one and a kind of a darker gru one. Well, those aren't as separate as red and black here. Then they'll get to those. That's interesting. Or they have two yellows. So where we just see yellow and then another example of that ugly color yellow. For them, there are two yellows. And so if you give them a bunch of chips, they quite immediately separate kind of the bone-colored one from the egg yolk-colored one or whatever the actual colors were. I haven't seen the actual set. And they do that more quickly than English speakers. It's not that English speakers don't see the difference, but for them, it's just poop, poop. Nothing could be more obvious. So that seems to indicate that, okay, your language channels your disposition to the world somewhat. But then we have to remember the claim that's being made. We have someone talking about culture. We have someone talking about ways of thinking and channeling. Now, so far, that experiment shows that there's certain subtle differences in how they see color based on their grammar. Nothing remotely as exciting as what we've been promised. Very recent work has shown that if you ask certain Europeans who have gender what voice inanimate objects would talk in, that this correlates meaningfully with what the gender of the word happens to be in their language. And so in French, table is la table. And more often than not, a French speaker, if asked how a table would talk in a cartoon, thinks that the table would talk like a girl, much more than we English speakers would. Like, this may be my internal craziness. I think of tables as men. If I have to assign any gender to them, because tables have kind of square corners and, you know, are kind of inert, nothing about a table reminds me of a woman. But for them, the table talks kind of like this. Right, that's interesting. But once again, is that culture? You know, for one thing, French people do not walk around thinking about this sort of thing consciously. You have to elicit it very carefully in experiments. And if you've hung out with any French people, you know that their vision of the world does not involve different cartoon voices for objects based on whether they're men or women. And I've asked many Europeans, do you think of these genders, such as Germans with the forks and the knives and the spoons? They say, no, that knife is not neuter. It's just a knife. Now let's eat. And so these things are very subtle. And in any case, even if underlyingly there are these little blips with the gender and the color, it's nothing like the grammar, channeling, thought, culture, and even disposition that you see in the way Benjamin Lee Worf was arguing. So what I wanted to show is that language and culture are not as tightly linked as we're often taught, and that I'm talking about a kind of self-directed change that's mediated by how many people are learning the language non-natively. And that's something that has a kinship with the way natural things develop, like animals and plants. It's linked to culture. It's something that we can talk about, but not in this course, and not as intimate as we're often told. And the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis in general, as enticing as it is, has never been proven to remotely the extent that is often implied.
Lecture 27, Language Starts Over, Pigeons.
We've seen that the nature of language is that it becomes more complex through time. Simplification nibbles at the margins, but a normal language maintains a very high degree of complexity. That's just a universal. The only thing that stops that from happening is when large groups of people are learning that language as adults and therefore shaving it down somewhat. So we've seen intermediate cases of that sort, such as English and Mandarin Chinese, but there are times when that process goes a lot further. There are times when language gets shaved down to the point that really it isn't a language at all. And that happens so much around the world, and it's been so important for the development of certain new languages that we have to talk about that in this lecture. Most of us have had experiences like this. We've heard people talking like this, and we may have done it. Many years ago, I went to Russia, and I knew very little Russian at the time, and I kind of tried to cram it into my head about 10 minutes before I went, but obviously that didn't work. I probably knew less Russian after I did that than I had before. So I went to Russia, and most of the people I was dealing with did not speak English, and so I had to make do with my fragmentary Russian. And so I was using the language, but on a very rudimentary level. At one stall before a jazz concert, there were the most beautiful apricots I've ever seen, all lined up on a ledge. They were light orange and big and Russian. They were beautiful apricots. And then they had all these other things in the kiosk. And so I pointed at them and I said, abrikosi, because I thought that was the word. And the woman looked at me, said, what? And I said, abrikosi. And she kind of turned around, and about 5 minutes later, she came back with this piping hot cup of coffee. To this day, I don't know what I did wrong, but I didn't know how to say I would like or that thing behind you or anything like that. At one point, I was trying to get tea with sugar and tea without sugar, tea with for me and tea without for the person I was with. And without and with involve mastering the cases in Russian. And I didn't know any cases. And so I went in and I insisted on doing the speaking, and I was leaving out the cases, and the little girl with the mother behind the counter was laughing at me and pointing because I must have sounded like a perfect jackass. What I was doing was speaking pidgin Russian. Now, of course, this was just me running around in St. Petersburg, but imagine if there were a lot of over-ambitious linguistically Americans running around St. Petersburg, and we were stuck there for the rest of our lives speaking this bad Russian and never getting any better. It might be that after a while we would all start making the same kinds of mistakes in common, and we'd have a whole rudimentary system that we could use with each other, and that Russians would learn to get patient and understand. That's called a pidgin. Basically, there are many cases in the world where you don't need to learn more of a language except maybe a few hundred words and a very rudimentary sense of the grammar, like maybe just what order words happen to come in. If that's the furthest you need to go, then that's a type of speaking, and that's called pidgin. Not pidgin as in the little birds. You ever wondered why you never see baby pigeons? Think about that. You would expect to see a big pigeon and then little babies trailing behind. You never see them. They just kind of pop out. Anyway, not pigeon as in P-I-G-E-O-N, but P-I-D-G-I-N. And where it comes from, that word, is Chinese, Peijin, Cantonese. That is what traders in Canton called the pidgin English that they use there from the 1600s into the 1900s. Pidgins have formed all over the world, probably to some extent throughout human history. They often happen during trade. So, for example, there was a time when, starting in the late 1700s, every summer, Russian traders would spend the summer in Norway. And so the Russians would bring timber, and the Norwegians had fish from the fjords. And so they'd spend those 2 or 3 months trading. Now, Russian and Norwegian are very different languages, and no one had any reason for Russia to learn Norwegian. Norwegians certainly were not going to deal with mastering Russian. I wouldn't wish it on anybody unless it was absolutely necessary, but they did have to communicate. English was not yet the international language at this time, so what do you do? Now, you can use signs. To an extent, Native Americans use sign language, not for fun or to give American children later kind of a little backseat game to play. But they were using it for communication. But you can only go so far with sign language, with especially with just the hands, and when it's not used fluently the way American Sign Language for non-hearing people is used. And you might have a list of words, but this is for the summer. So it's not just that they're trading across a stream for a week. This is a whole summer. You need a little more. But nobody needed to learn Norwegian, nobody needed to learn Russian. So they came up with a cross between the two. And it is called, by linguists who've looked at what they were speaking since, Rusa-Norsk. No one at the time called it that. No one at the time thought of it as a language. They called it Moya Patvoya, which in the pidgin meant me in yours. The idea being that they thought that they were kind of coming into the middle. So a phrase of Rusa-Norsk was, there's a dog on my ship which went, Sabaku Pomoya Skib. So that's dog on my ship. So there's a dog on my ship. Sabaku comes from the Russian word for dog. It's actually marked as an object, but no one knew that in the pidgin. It's just there. So Sabaku. And then Skib, Sabaku Pomoya Skib. Skib is kind of a permutation of our word ship. That's Norwegian for ship. And so the dog is from Russia and the ship is from Norway. Moya Skib. The Moya is from Russian, but it's something that a Norwegian wouldn't have any trouble with because these are both Indo-European languages where words for I and my tend to begin with M and be followed by a vowel. So my is going to be something like my, main, mean, moi, mo. That's something that anybody in Europe can kind of recognize. Then pa. And so sabaku pa moya skib. The pa is something which has a vaguely prepositional meaning in both Norwegian and in Russian. Speakers of either one can recognize pa as meaning something like at, on, along those lines. And so, moya patvoya, mine, kind of in, at, in, yours. Now, it was a pidgin, and therefore Rusa-Norsk had no articles. Norwegian has articles, Russian doesn't, Rusa-Norsk did not. No tense marking, certainly there was no gender, no case markers, no verb conjugations. It was a very simple kind of language. There are only about 300 words in it. In other words, it was what you needed to have basic jocular conversations with these people you were spending the summer with, especially when you were probably huddling with your own kind most of the time. There seems, based on the topics that most of the material in Rusa-Norsk that remains behind discussed, to have been a lot of alcohol involved in these settings. And so that probably decreased the coherence and nuance of the conversation. So really, you only needed about 300 words, just like in a bar in America today. So Rusa-Norsk was very typical in terms of pidgins, in not being a real language, not having any kind of real structure. And so, for example, the preposition, this po, was a double, triple, quadruple duty preposition. Any kind of prepositional concept that you wanted to render was po. So, at my house, po moya stova. To archangel, po archangel. Into the water, like if you take a dog and throw it into the water. Po vater, on the land, po lan, And so this is the sort of thing that happens. One word is put through its paces instead of having separate words for all of these things. Now, it wasn't completely word soup. There were some tendencies, not necessarily rules, but tendencies. There were some ways of speaking Russo-Norse that sounded more normal than others. So, for example, the fact that that all-purpose preposition is po. Norwegian has many, many prepositions. Russian has many, many prepositions. And there are all sorts that you could take from Norwegian or Russian that could have that all-purpose sense, including some that would make a certain sense to speakers of both. But it happened to be po that was chosen. And so you couldn't just use any old preposition from your language. It was po. That was kind of a rule. And you can see things like that happening even today. I had a student in one of my classes who decided to watch a pidgin form by giving a bunch of students a series of a few hundred nonsense words for very basic meanings and seeing what kind of grammar happened. And there was one word for bag, and oddly enough, the students started using the word for bag as a way of turning other words into a noun, especially when the noun is something that's being used. And so there was no word for car in the original set, so when they started wanting to talk about a car, they talked about a go bag. And so the bag is what made it a vehicle. There was no word for television set, so they started calling TV C-bag. And this was just something that happened. One person did it. It was kind of cute. And so then somebody else started doing it. And pretty soon, that was just the way that you use bag. That's how a pidgin coalesces. So that was a rule. Now, of course, this language that these kids came up with was not one that you could write the preamble to the Constitution in. But it did have this way of making something into a noun with the noun bag. So that's how pidgins go. Now, Russo-Norsk is one where it split the difference between languages about 50-50. So there was Russian and there was Norwegian. Usually, most of the words in a pidgin come from one language. And usually, pidgins form in situations where there is subordination between groups. For people to come together on equal footing, as we all know, is unfortunately not the usual situation. Generally, somebody's got the juice. And so it's more the subordinate group learning the dominant group's language than the other way around. A typical example of this was actually the way Native Americans spoke in this country back in the early days. Hollywood often has the Indian, well, no, not has, had the Native American talking in a certain way we're all familiar with. So, you know, big chief, go that way, ugh. And that was just kind of accepted. And it wasn't always a Bugs Bunny joke either, because Tonto on The Lone Ranger was depicted as speaking that way. And what was interesting is that Tonto and The Lone Ranger, by implication, were together all the time. And The Lone Ranger spoke, frankly, for his station, a rather unusually pristine, mainstream, educated English. And Tonto is always 2 feet away from him for what I imagine was several decades during which they never aged and seemed very healthy. And somehow Tonto is always speaking this kind of pidgin. That was, of course, ridiculous. But the way the Native American was depicted as speaking did have some basis in fact, as we would expect. And so at first, the continent was populated by hundreds of groups of Native Americans. Some Europeans came. As we all know, the early Europeans had to be taught how to deal with the land, etc. There used to be many, many more Native Americans than whites. And then as time went on, whites proliferated and the Native Americans became the subordinate group. And as we would expect, most Native Americans, until their almost complete acculturation in many places now, were not inclined to become Europeans. They were keeping their languages and their cultures and their folkways, and communicating with the Europeans was something that they wanted to do on a makeshift basis. So, many Native Americans, up until the 1800s in particular, tended to communicate with the white man in pidgin English. Now, of course, nobody put it that way, but looking back on the documentation, there was an American Indian pidgin English. And it wasn't just a bunch of Native Americans not speaking English right. There were conventions in this American Indian pidgin English that you could see across the country. So, for example, heap really was used as very. So heap big teepee. That is something that Native Americans actually did say. It wasn't just a Bugs Bunny convention, and this was something that you found, squaw for woman. That actually came from the Narragansett language of Rhode Island, and it was common across the country for Native Americans when speaking English to refer to women as squaws. So there was a convention. There was a sort of a Russo-Norse in America, which was Native Americans, making do with this imposed language to the extent that they had to. So one quote from American Indian Pidgin English is a woman, a female Native American, who is disrespecting a man of whiteness. And so she said, "You silly, you weak, you baby hands, no catch horse, no kill buffalo, no good but for sit still, read book." That's pretty mean. And that is American Indian Pidgin English. Of course, that does not represent the full battery of expression in the English language. However, it's also articulate in its way. The meaning comes across. Another passage of it is a male Native American who is giving some sort of pickup advice, I suppose. And he says, "Look squaw in face, see him smile," which is all one, he say yes. The all one is like to indicate that the squaw, he says yes. And notice, this is not the business of the squaw being he does not represent some sort of advanced conception of gender relations. This is an example of how pidgins tend to leave out the complicated stuff, such as gender. So for us, we think, well, of course there's he and there's she. But many, many languages in the world do not distinguish he and she. Japanese doesn't, Finnish doesn't. My general sense, just kind of flying by the seat of my pants, is that probably as many languages don't, as do, if you're really dealing with all 6,000. Well, so it's a complication. You don't usually need to be told whether the person you're talking about is male or female. It's usually quite clear. Rarely do you say, was it a boy or a girl? It's usually not important. And so, in a pidgin, often you just go down to one gender. For better or for worse, the default gender does tend to be the masculine gender. So the squaw is a him. Not because the squaw shaves in the morning, but because everything is him. There is no her. So look squaw in face, see him smile, which is all one he say yes. So that's a pidgin, American Indian Pidgin English. We naturally see that as, well, they didn't speak English right. And they most certainly didn't. Pidgins are not real languages. But what they're doing is something that people have done all over the world for as long as we know. When you have an intermediate need or desire to learn a language and you just need to communicate. So seeing the gender disappear is one symptom of something which is common in pidgins. As a matter of fact, it defines the pidgin, which is massive simplification far beyond what you would expect of a language developing in the normal way. Languages don't take off all their clothes like this naturally. This is something that happens artificially. So, for example, the sound system in a pidgin is very simplified. English has 5 vowel symbols in its alphabet, which we call A, E, I, O, and U, but that actually is an abbreviation of the actual number of vowel sounds we have. So we actually have not just A, E, I, O, U, but we have A, A, E, A, E, I, O, A, U, U. We have all sorts of vowel sounds, and the symbols are just a vague representation of what's going on. Our spelling system is notoriously awful, and we just learn how to deal with that misfit between how we actually talk and what these alphabetic symbols are. But pidgins actually do tend to drop down to about 5 vowels like this. So the well-behaved pidgin will have a, e, I, o, u. And the other stuff, the is and the as and the us, those sounds are not as common in the world's languages, and those are the ones that tend to be leached out in a pidgin. Pidgins also drop the sounds that are harder to learn. So there's the famous example of the clicks in southern Africa. Zulu is one of the languages that has some of these clicks. There's a pidgin Zulu, very commonly spoken in South Africa. It's called Fanakalo. Interesting, Fanakalo means in the pidgin, you go do that, which indicates that the pidgin developed, as many of them do, in a situation of coerced labor. Fanakalo developed among people working in mines from various places near South Africa, brought in to do unpleasant work. And Fanakalo is you go do this. But Fanakalo is a pidgin based on Zulu, and that is, it's a very simplified Zulu. And you would predict that the first thing that would go in any click language would be those clicks. They are very difficult to learn unless you have a pretty incredible talent after you have passed a certain critical phase of language acquisition abilities. So phonic hello speakers tend to replace the clicks with just a K. So all these sounds, they all do sound kind of like K. That's what they go to in phonic hello. Zulu has tones. Tones are hard to learn if your language doesn't have tones. One language's tones are even hard to learn if your language has different tones. So phonic hello doesn't have any tones. Phonic hello is a pidgin Zulu. Then there is small vocabulary. And so if you want to say things beyond the very basic in a pidgin, then you use circumlocutions. And so you might have a go bag. Or there was this Chinese pidgin English. In Canton, there was a resistance for a long time to Westerners coming in to trade. And when the Chinese there finally opened themselves up to it, what they did was keep English speakers out in the bay. They were rarely allowed to come inland, and they were only spoken to in a pidgin kind of English. That was Chinese pidgin English, and it lived for a long time. The word for goose in Chinese pidgin English was big fella quack quack maki go in wata, which is what a goose is. Geese are, if you've ever met a goose, geese are big. They can hurt you. And they do make a quackish sound, and they're in the water. Now, you don't talk about geese much. I've probably said the word goose in my life. I've lived 38 years. I've probably said goose maybe 60 times. I don't talk about geese, and here I am talking about them. But if you were in Canton and you had to talk about those obnoxious birds, then you'll put something together. Big fella, quack, quack, maki, go in water. And then there is context. Context means a lot in a pidgin. It would be hard to write in the prose style of, say, a Milton or a William F. Buckley in pidgin, because it's not disembodied. It's about what's going on now, and in a way, you use language just to illustrate what's going on in very broad strokes. It's just a support. It's just one part of the stew. So there was pidgin Eskimo for a long time. The languages that the Eskimos speak are hideously complex, and because the weather is hideously cold, most people who aren't natives don't go there to stay. You don't vacation there. You don't get a split level there. You're just there for a short period of time. And so naturally, there was an Eskimo pidgin. So if you wanted to say something like, I want the dogs to come, then the way you'd say it would be kimik ka'ili pitsutu. That's the way you would say it. And those are the words that mean basically dog, come, want. But that could answer various questions. You could say dog come want kimi ka'ili pitsutu in any sorts of situations. Somebody might ask you, why are you whistling? And you'll say kimi ka'ili pitsutu, because I want the dog to come, because I want the dogs to come, because I want my dogs to come, because I want your dogs to come. Or why do you want Jim? Because I want him to bring me a dog. Dog come want would take care of it. Why are you locking the door? Because dogs keep trying to get into the house. You know, dog, they want to come in. Or why did Jim go to Fort McPherson? Because he wants to get some dogs there. Dogs come want. All that could be said because this isn't a real language. It's really just kind of telegraphically indicating the high spots of language. Context has to do the rest. If the dogs are trying to come in, you know. And so this little three-word sentence will take care of any lack of clarity you have about implications or desires or what's going to happen next. So this leads to the fact that, for example, in the Pacific Northwest, there was a pidgin called Chinook jargon, and it was used between the many Native American groups who lived there. Chinook jargon was a highly watered-down version of the languages Chinook and Nootka up there. And it was often said that the Native Americans up there were rather taciturn when speaking. I genuinely don't know whether most Native Americans are known for having the taciturnity of the Tonto stereotype. In the Pacific Northwest, apparently this had some sort of anthropological validity, although I'm sure it varied among individuals. But among when they were speaking Chinook jargon, suddenly they became very animated because so little was actually indicated by Chinook jargon itself that if you wanted to fill in the emotions or the nuances, you had to wave your hands around, you had to wiggle your eyebrows, you had to move, etc. So pidgins only help you to communicate. They're not true languages themselves. Now, when we look at pigeons like that, we do have to look at one last thing to make sure we're clear on what the difference between, for example, not having any endings or prefixes is and being a pigeon. So, for example, if a language like Rusinorsk or American Indian Pidgin English is not a real language, then why is Chinese a real language when Chinese leaves a lot to context as well? That telegraphic quality is actually quite common in Southeast Asia and East Asia. If you learn Japanese, the general feeling you often have is these people don't seem to need to actually say much of anything. And so I like John in Japanese, if somebody wants to just say that, like they're sitting on your lap and they say, I like John. Then what they say is, John like. Well, there's no I. How come you don't need to specify yourself? Well, technically, I know that the person is saying it and they're referring to themselves, but you would think a language would do that from an ethnocentric English perspective. So why is it that Japanese is a real language, but these pigeons aren't? And that means that we have to remember, for example, that Chinese has the tones. So you don't have to specify whether it's a cat or the cat. But on the other hand, only tone tells you whether you're talking about a piece of rope or licentiousness or a horse or someone's mother. So that is an elaboration that you do not have in any pigeon. Pigeons do not use tone in anything approaching that way. As we also saw in an earlier lecture, Chinese has numeral classifiers. And so you'll say two head of cattle, but then three of pencils, and then four of animals. And there's a different kind of classifier for each sort of thing. The little sounds I made are not the words, but just hypothetically, there's a different one. And there are long lists of these classifiers, dividing the world into classes of things that we English speakers would never think about. In Chinese Pidgin English, based on that feature in Cantonese, there was only one classifier and not usually used. And so that complication got leached out. And then there's also the vocabulary. Chinese languages have a very large and a very subtle vocabulary. And this is part of being a quote-unquote real language. So as we saw, when you're talking about 150,000 words, that's probably a language that's been cast into writing. But even languages that are not written have typically a few tens of thousands of words. And so there's no such thing as a language where subtle concepts simply cannot be expressed. There are always little holes, and so the French have a word for the kind of person who's always cold, frileux. We don't have that. But then we've got a great deal of other things. The French cannot say your car is kind of sticking out in a line compared to all the other ones. You have to pull your car in. They can express it, but it's not easy. They have to kind of talk around it. Every language has its little gaps. But in general, every language allows you to speak in a real way. Pigeons, on the other hand, cannot distinguish, for example, nibble from bite, from munch, from graze, from gnash, from fondue. There's no such thing as that. For them, it's all just a matter of, you know, shoving it in your mouth. All pigeons have a word for eat, and there you go. There's no nibble. For them, it would be eaty, 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 small, or something like that. But that's not a word. That's an accident. So it's not that a language that doesn't have endings is a pigeon. I remember once I was at a very bad party, and a woman pinned me in the corner, and she had been in the Peace Corps, and she had learned the language Chui. And oddly enough, Chui, a West African language, has a structure that a Chinese person would find much easier to pick up than we would. It's a language with very short words and tones, and it's put together kind of on a Chinese-y game plan. And the woman was not a linguist, and so I completely understood the source of her misconception, but she kept regaling me with her wonder at the fact that Chui had no grammar. Now, what she meant that there was no hablo, hablas, habla, hablamos, hablais, hablan. So, for her, that's grammar. But then if you don't have the endings, then there's no grammar. And I kind of wanted to ask her, although I don't ask people things like this at parties, what did you think of those tones that you probably couldn't learn? You know, because the tones are very complicated, and then the way each word combines based on its tones. Not only is it hard, but if you make a mistake, often you've said a whole different word, and even if speakers can recover what you mean from context, you sound really, really funny. If you're trying to learn Chinese and you try to render the Chinese to a native speaker, watch the smile come up on their face unless you're an incredible mimic, just because your tones sound off. It sounds like intonation being off in our language, but I get the sense 10 times worse. Clearly, she ran up against this in Ghana, because they have the same kinds of tones. But for her, whatever that was, it wasn't grammar. Completely understandable mistake, but we're not going to make that mistake. And so it's not just about endings. It's about there not being anything complicated. It's about there not being a real vocabulary. That's what a pidgin is. And so they're not real languages. What they are is adults' partial version of real languages. But pidgins become the basis of creoles, which is the topic of our next lectures.
Lecture 28, Language Starts Over, Creoles, Part 1.
So pidgins are not real languages, but as far as real languages go, as we've seen, technically there's no such thing as a new language because all languages have been passed down since the dawn of human time. All of today's languages are continuations of earlier ones, which all trace back ultimately to the first language. But there are some examples in the world which are the closest that we know of to new languages. And this happens when people are speaking pidgins, and then for some reason, sociohistory has it that they have to speak this pidgin as an everyday language for the rest of their lives. Now, that's hard for us to imagine if we went to Russia and butchered the language. Part of the reason that we never got any further is because that's all we needed. We weren't going to stay in Russia. If you go to Fiji, your Fijian's probably never going to be very good. Berlitz doesn't have a Fijian course, but you don't need to be that good because you're coming home. But that's not the way it has always been for various people on Earth. And so, for example, suppose you were one of the slaves brought from Africa to a plantation, usually in the New World. And suppose this was a situation where, very naturally, you developed a pidgin version of the English or the French or the Dutch or the Spanish or the Portuguese that you were exposed to, but you're not going home. And so you're going to be using that pidgin for the rest of your life, all day, every day. What's interesting is that human beings seem to have not only a universal genetic specification for language, but a universal need to really communicate. If all you've got is a pidgin and you have to use that for the rest of your life, then chances are you are going to expand that into a real language. People have a need to communicate on a real, nuanced level. So if you end up using a pidgin far beyond what the pidgin was intended for, you go beyond summer up in the fjords or disrespecting a man who's chasing you when you're a Native American, then you expand the pidgin into a real language. That real language is called a creole. And so that's what a creole language is. A creole is not only something having to do with Louisiana. We'll get back to that. But a creole is something that comes from a pidgin. So creoles definitely have a relationship to languages that came before. For example, there's some language that provides most of the creole's words, and we'll talk about its grammar. But to an extent, creoles are language born again. Or at best, creoles are language stripped way, way, way down and then built back up in directions other than the directions that were followed by that language that provided most of its words. So, pidgin to creole is a kind of life cycle. Now, there are actually only a few cases where history allows us to see both the pidgin and the creole. In the vast majority of cases, we have the creole, the pidgin part we have to infer. But there are some cases where we really have the whole history before us, and one of them is in the South Seas. And so, for example, in the late 1700s, the English colonized Australia, and they traded with the Aboriginal people there, And understandably, the Aboriginals at first were not inclined to learn English in anything but a makeshift way. And so there was, big surprise, a pidgin English, a nice pidgin English with a certain amount of rules that grew up for use between the English and the people who lived in this place natively. So a certain way of speaking English arose there, but the English extended their business to Oceania, to the east of Australia, the various islands to the east, and they started using various indigenous people of these islands in various trades. For a while, it was whaling, then it was collecting sandalwood, and then it was collecting sea cucumbers, which were used for soup by various people who thankfully are removed from me in time and place. But all of these things took work, and these things took work that Englishmen were often not willing to do. And so native inhabitants of the islands were taken to do this. There is, roughly speaking, at least one language per island in this region, often many languages on an island. So there was no question of the English learning all of these languages. These men, conscripted, often on a much more permanent basis than they had thought they were agreeing to, into these trades, ended up learning a rudimentary kind of English. So all around the region, there was what can be generically called a kind of South Seas pidgin. It had a small vocabulary. It had rudimentary structure. We first start finding evidence of this coalescing in the early 1800s. So one of the early quotes is the following. Kanaka is the name for indigenous inhabitant used by both the indigenous inhabitants in the South Seas pidgin as well as whites. So, no, we all the same are you. Suppose one got money, all got money. You, suppose one got money, lock him up in chest. No good. Kanaka oli sama one. What that means is that the white man tends to have money as a piece of property and to keep it for himself, whereas the Kanaka, the indigenous person, has what we might call a more communitarian approach to money. And what's interesting about this to linguists and anthropologists is that this is an example of South Seas pidgin as early as 1835. Now, this was around, and then there started to be more established sorts of settings. So the English established plantations in Queensland, and this was specifically on the upper eastern coast of Australia. And you have to have people to work on the plantations. And using Africans was going out of fashion at this point, and so they had to get other people. So they took people from New Guinea, which was nearby, and several of these islands in Oceania, and had them work on long-term contracts on these plantations. Now, the workers spoke several different languages, and so the South Seas pidgin became how you communicated in this setting. And so here's a situation where the pidgin is not being used just while you chop up sea cucumbers for somebody or just while you trade some things with somebody over in Australia, then go back to your Aboriginal village. Instead, you're on a plantation using this for years and years. Your language, which nobody's ever heard of except you and the 700 other people who speak it, is of no use. So you have to use the pidgin. That's the way you communicate. So it ends up being used on that basis. And then there was a practice where many of the men, going back to their islands, continued using the language among each other, partly because its use as a lingua franca was useful even back on the island if there was more than one language, and it was seen as a kind of a badge of having been through that experience of working under the English. And so it lived on those islands. When the pidgin was used to this extent, it ended up being expanded. And so people did not stick with the rudimentary structure of things like the early quote that I mentioned. So the pidgin was still around for people who did not use the language much. And so you got sentences like, you plenty lie, which means that you lie a lot. Plenty was a custom in this South Seas pidgin, meaning very or being an intensifier. So you plenty lie. You afraid me satil. You're afraid that I'm going to steal. Me no satil. Me come worship. What for you look me satil? That was just very basic pidgin. That is not a human being communicating in any nuanced fashion. That is a kind of exclamatory and basic accusatory statement. This person has a native language where they can actually speak. But South Seas pidgin in various places became a real language. One of the real languages that it became, survives, and thrives today It has the unfortunate name of Tok Pisin. Pisin is business in the phonology, the sound system of this language. And so that's what the Pisin means. And Tok is talk. And so business talk. And that, of course, would have been one of the uses of Tok Pisin at first as a pidgin, enabling people who speak various languages to trade. But nowadays, it is very much the lingua franca of Papua New Guinea. And it's even used in the government. There is a newspaper in it. Advertisements are in it. And Tok Pisin, although it grew out of this South Seas pidgin, is a language. So, for example, if you want to say, she goes to market in Tok Pisin, then it's emigo long market. Long is a general purpose preposition in Tok Pisin. And so it's not along the market, that's to the market. So emigo long market. She goes to the market. Now, if you want to say she goes to the market regularly, then you have a marker. And so, emi save go long market. And then, if she's going to the market right now, then it's emi go long market istap. And the stop is from stop, and so it's kind of like she stops going to the market, but it means stops within the going, as in it's a prolonged action. So, emi go long market istap. If it's she has gone to the market, then it's emi go long market pinis. Pinis is finish. And so what we know of as an F transmutes into a P. That's what pinis means. So emi go long market pinis. Or she went to market, emi bin go long market. She will go to the market, embi go long market. In other words, this has what we know as grammar. And these are not accidental things. These are very much what you need to describe how to speak Tok Pisin. So South Seas pidgin was makeshift. It wasn't something you could be all that good at. It wasn't anything anybody would consider themselves, anybody would consider their language. Tok Pisin is a language. You can speak it well. You can speak it badly. There's even a variety that native speakers of it, which there now are, laugh at, thinking of it as Tok Master, the talk of the master, which is the way whites often speak it. Like, decently, but clearly not in a way that is really in their veins. That's very much a language. Example. Heavy means heavy in the most literal sense. But there's another meaning of it. It means difficulty. And so you have a heaviness. We don't use heaviness that way. They do. In other words, they're idiomatic uses of words in Tok Pisin. Or if you want to say that you're sad, you say bel belong me e heavy. Bel is belly, blong me is my, so my belly is heavy. That doesn't mean that you need to go on a diet, it doesn't mean that you're pregnant, it means that you are sad because you have a heavy belly, with the belly being considered the center of emotion. So it's a language. It's actually a language. It's an interesting and nuanced language. It started as something that wasn't, which was the South Seas pidgin, but now it is one. So Tok Pisin is a creole, and it is one of many creoles in the world. Wherever people are forced to take a pidgin or some really non-native level of competence, even if it's not quite as extreme as a pidgin, and make that into a regular language rather than just learning the language that provided the words itself. If that situation arises, then you have a creole. So, what about Louisiana? Louisiana is one of many places where slaves were brought to work plantations, and there was a language spoken which they learned very quickly and not being taught. So there was no blackboard. Nobody gave them French verb conjugations because slaves were brought to the plantation. Generally, the main concern was work, and so you worked slaves. And so they were learning French in these very untutored conditions. They needed to learn it fast. And so they first developed the pidgin French, and then they expanded it into a real language, but not French. It was an expansion of the pidgin into a real language. So in Louisiana, they speak what a linguist would call Louisiana Creole French. And it's a very interesting language in its own right. It's also endangered. Louisiana blacks call that language Creole as if that's the only one. But in fact, there are many languages in the world whose speakers call their language Creole who aren't aware of the one in Louisiana. Creole is a type of language. So, for example, Louisiana is one place where slaves were brought to plantations, but of course there were many others. Where that happened in Jamaica, the language today is called Patois, but actually it's Jamaican Creole English. Where that happened in Haiti, it is called Creole because it is a Creole. Where that happened in Curaçao, then it's called Papiamentu, but actually what that is a Spanish Creole. So, the whole slave trade, in particular, created a whole series of these Creole languages. And in fact, most Creoles were born in plantation settings of various kinds. There was the African setting. There was the history that I just described of Tokpisin. Tokpisin is one of a bunch of sisters that are very sister dialects that are very similar to each other. And then there are Creoles in some other places. On the West African coast, there are Creoles based on Portuguese, because the Portuguese were the first to come down the West African coast and explore. And when they did that, there were interactions with Africans, and these were predictably in Pidgin Portuguese. In some situations, the Pidgin expanded into a Creole. So Cape Verdeans speak a Creole Portuguese. Not only is it a different kind of Portuguese, as someone might tell you, but it's one that was born amidst this pigeonizing history followed by being rebuilt into a beautiful new language of its own. And as you go further down the West African coast, you see other Portuguese Creoles like that. There are also Portuguese Creoles, most of them dying, spoken in India and in Indonesia, because the Portuguese, so counterintuitively, given the fact that Portugal is about the size of a parking lot and plays, with all due love for the Portuguese, a very small geopolitical role today, they were actually the kick-butt explorers of a particular time. They actually ruled the world to an extent. The Portuguese, there are only like 7 people in the whole country. And so there are these Creoles based on that now small language in many parts of the world. And then there is a French Creole in Mauritius, which is off of Madagascar, which is itself off the southeastern coast of Africa. And so there are many Creoles in many places. There is a Creole based on Arabic, which is spoken in Uganda and Kenya. And there are Creoles based on various languages, but most of them are based on Western European languages because of the geopolitical things that happened starting in the late 1400s and continuing, in some cases, up until the beginning of the 20th century. So, another wrinkle is that there's a terminological problem. I'm telling you that a pidgin is a rudimentary non-language and that a Creole is something that develops out of a pidgin. But actually, there are many places in the world where what we think of as a Creole scientifically, i.e., it's a full language that can be spoken well or spoken badly and is a vehicle of nuance, is still called pidgin by its speakers for various reasons. So, for example, Hawaii is home to fine Creole English, and yet it's called pidgin by its speakers because of terminology that was in the air over 100 years ago when that language developed. Or a very interesting movement was that there were slaves who were taken, ex-slaves who were taken from Jamaica back across the Atlantic Ocean to the West African coast. And they settled first in Sierra Leone and then moved down that coast. So that today there is a version of West Indian Patois, which is spoken not only in Sierra Leone, but in Ghana and in Nigeria and in Cameroon. All of those are essentially variations on the same language. A person from Jamaica can actually have a conversation with someone speaking the same language with variation in Nigeria. However, on the West African coast, that language is often called pidgin. Cameroonians will say they speak pidgin. Nigerians will say they speak pidgin. You can find a Ghanaian who will admit that they speak it, although they definitely do, although they tend not to be aware that it's a whole different language that they should be proud to speak. They will say, oh, well, that's the pidgin. But they're speaking the same Creole that's being spoken in Jamaica and Antigua and all the other islands. So there's that part. So in the world, what is a Creole is often called a pidgin. You know that this quote-unquote pidgin is a Creole if it's a real language. Somebody speaking a pidgin is clearly speaking something halting. That's me making a fool of myself asking for tea. That's pidgin. Creole is real speech. So Creoles are the closest thing we have to brand new languages. And we have to make sure that we understand that there's a difference between Creole and dialect. As with so many things that are sometimes challenging for us to wrap our heads around, it's a continuum phenomenon. So there are some languages that kind of teeter between being a dialect of something and being a complete